it doesn't have to be perfect in the field, and the two are not like the data noise that you get from perhaps a lack of reliability or some noise is like that's a valuable thing because that's the world, that's it's where we are, it's where it's messy. So I think the two work together. You've got a supercomputer sitting between your ears, some more super than others, and it is taking all of the signals, which we can measure and not measure, and giving you an output as a single number. Like that's like pretty amazing stuff. Models and AI and all of these things that we build, they don't care about physiology. They don't understand physiology and they don't use physiology. They use numbers. And that's super important to understand because if it says this and your physiological understanding is different, it doesn't matter. Whatever it is, make sure that you pass the pillow test. This is something we used to talk about a lot in medicine. Pillow test is like when your head hits the pillow, are you comfortable at night? Can you go to sleep? Because if you are, then that's all that really matters.
Welcome to the Upside Strength Podcast, the show that will help you get your health and your performance to the next level. Whether you're a recreational or competitive athlete, a coach, a physio, or even just someone who's curious about sport, sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode. David, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm great. Thank you. And thanks for having me. Really excited to be here and appreciative of the opportunity.
Excited to have you on. For the three listeners that don't know you yet, can you give us a brief overview? Who are you? What you do?
I mean, if it's only three, I'm doing pretty well. Yeah, I guess geez, it's a hard story, but I have degrees in exercise physiology, podiatry, and medicine. I sort of went through those periods. I was coaching at a semi-elite level in Australia, doing some S&C. I've coached a bunch of team sports, coached a bunch of endurance sports as well, individual athletes. You know, as I said, worked clinically in podiatry, worked clinically in medicine for a little while, ended up finding my way to Europe via my wife, or meeting my wife, who wasn't my wife at the time, came to, you know, went to Amsterdam. That sort of saw me back into some coaching specifically, specifically rugby league of all things in Amsterdam, and then getting heavily involved in the rugby union set up there. Had a bit of a Ted Lasso moment where I was kind of nightmares and like way stressed out about it all and taking it way too seriously. My wife sort of turned to me and said, listen, you should probably ease off a bit and maybe not coach so much. And that was kind of as COVID was hitting as well. And that saw me transition into working in tech. And so now I work in tech startups and sort of still do some coaching a little bit on the side, like a couple of people here or there, do quite a lot of podcasting and otherwise sort of straddle the space between health and performance, I guess, based on my background. So I guess that's a quick one.
I like it. Yeah. Excited to get into all the details. You started in exercise physiology, as you said, or it's one of your many fields of expertise. What would you say has changed the most since your initial training in the field and your vision today?
I think wearables is the answer, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Like when I was, you know, I started my degree in 2005. And at that stage, you know, you learn all the physiology, but it's all like in a lab. And I think at that stage, we were pre GPS watches, certainly had heart rate monitors. Like I remember using those, but I mean, we weren't at a GPS watch stage. So for most people listening to this, they're probably like, what do you mean we didn't have GPS watches? Like they weren't a thing. So when you think about the data you could get from the field, like I remember like hanging a stopwatch on the fence, hitting start, going for a run and then coming back and like jamming stop on it to try and get my time for like 5Ks or whatever. So in context, lots has changed in terms of like the data we can gather from the field. And we can talk about validity and reliability of wearables of whatever type, right? Whatever field-based measures. But I think the fact that we can do field-based measuring at all is probably the biggest thing that's changed because now you can remove it from the lab. It's not such a sterile environment. And I'm super passionate about it doesn't have to be perfect in the field. And the two are not like the data noise that you get from perhaps a lack of reliability or some noise is like, that's a valuable thing because that's the world. It's where we are. It's where it's messy. So I think the two work together. You need the lab data, the lab research, but you certainly need the field stuff because otherwise like it's contextless. So yeah.
Let's take a second. I was going to come to wearables and tech a little bit later in our talk, but since we're here, let's get right into it. Let's play a little overrated, underrated game.
Okay.
So I'll give you some tools or some metrics we can quantify. And if you could give us your brief perspective on it, then we can maybe dive into some of those a little bit deeper. Let's start with the good old heart rate monitor.
I think it depends who you talk to. Like I have people in my life who certainly underrated and I have people in my life who probably overrated. I think I'd say probably as a blanket thing, I'd say in all aspects, the way I approach it is understand the sort, like what it's measuring, not what it's telling you it's measuring, right? So heart rate monitor is a perfect example. There are some optical ones, which are measuring changes in light. And there are some that are electrical, which are measuring electrical current in the heart. those things are not the same. They can mean the same thing when they output to a heart rate, but they may not. So you need to understand sources of error in those. And then you need to use multiple data points to corroborate the physiological picture you're seeing. So as an example, I was running Berlin Marathon a few years ago. I started out running, my RPE was low, and I was like, but I was running too fast, or I thought I was. I looked at my pace and I was like, so I have a pace data telling me I'm too fast. I have RPE data telling me I'm okay. Let's use other metrics. So I use my respiratory metrics. Can I nasal breathe? Am I comfortable here? And my heart rate. And I was like, no, based on heart rate and respiratory metrics and RPE, I'm comfortable at this pace. This is a good pace. It turned out it's probably a touch slow because I got to 39 kilometers because I was so conservative and so worried about being too fast. I got to 39 kilometers and I was like, actually, I can go here. And so I picked it up significantly from there. So that's an example of multiple metrics rather than relying on any one thing, because any one thing can have all sorts of problems. So heart rate, for instance, humidity, like, so temperature can change it, like how that measures, caffeine, all those things. So you got to understand, you know, what's being measured versus what it's telling you, and then perhaps sources of error as well, and then sources of data noise, I guess, as well.
All right, I'm going to push you a little bit more because I haven't heard an overrated or underrated in that statement. just as to be clear, I really appreciate your perspective on using those different perspectives to kind of triangulate. That's very much the way that I operate whenever we talk about, you know, measuring stuff inside the body or outside. But it's always interesting, I guess, in the current context and what you see, do you think it's over-indexed or under-indexed?
I'd say for beginners, they probably overemphasize it. And for elites, they probably underemphasize it.
So
I think it's, I think in elites, there's a lack of understanding in some contexts, not all elites, right? And these are broad brushstrokes, but I think there's this thought of I'm fit if it's low and I'm unfit if it's high, when certainly you can be overtraining and suppress it. And I think in beginners, there's this misunderstanding of the heart rate zones and the thought that the zones are hard and that you can't go over this, and, you know, all this sort of discussion around whatever it is, training zones. I think there's probably an overemphasis on that. So it's kind of probably reflects a little bit of the Dunning-Kruger effect of this, like, it probably reflects the Dunning-Kruger effect more than anything else.
Okay. I like it. GPS. Let's take two different contexts. Let's take on one side, maybe an endurance sport like running, and then on the other, something like rugby, since you've worked in team sports as well.
I think it's misused in rugby and underrated there. I think there's a lack of, like, high speed running is probably, you know, it's usually like 15 minutes, like 15 meters per second, I think it is. I can't remember the number now. Was it 15 kilometers an hour?
15 kilometers an hour, probably.
Yeah, 15 kilometers an hour. Sorry, please excuse my rustiness, but that's not really that high speed. And I think understanding there's nuance within that is super important, because, I mean, that's slower than I run a marathon in. Mm-hmm. So, like, for context, I'm not an elite marathoner, and that's slower than I run a marathon. That's not high speed running, especially not for guys who are fast. So I think there's a lack of texture there in that data. I think in a rugby context, one of the challenges we have is, like, not all load is running, and running load is very real and very relevant. But on, say, a wet day, you're going to have very, very, very low running loads, or it's going to look like there was a lot, like, very low load, but those are actually some of the harder games for all sorts of reasons in terms of physicality and that sort of stuff. So I think, and then there's positional differences in that. And I just think the reality is you don't have enough data scientists to spend enough time to make it meaningful in the ways I'm thinking about it, I guess, or I'm highlighting. In an endurance context, I think probably overrated, in that people treat their watch like it's gospel when it isn't. Because, you know, ultimately it's about, can you get to the finish line as quickly as possible, right? So most people finish any race with a metric on their watch that isn't the race metric. So whether it's more than 42.2 kilometers at the end of a marathon, or it's 10.1 kilometers at the end of a 10K, like, the goal is to get to the finish line, and they've measured that, and it has to be within a certain area. So whether it's GPS error or something like that. And I also think that too many people spend a lot of time obsessing about watch metrics when, you know, I think we're losing a feel for it. So I use the context of, you know, when I used to go out and run 5Ks and put a stopwatch on the fence, I ran with a guy at that time, and this guy was unbelievable. He could tell me what pace we were running at any given moment, and he could tell me how far we'd run. Now, I never got there. I was terrible at that sort of stuff, and I'm still not particularly good. And GPS has probably helped me in terms of learning it, because it's giving me better feedback. But we're losing that in people. There are people who couldn't tell you what pace they're running, couldn't tell you if it was the right effort levels, all that sort of stuff. So I think we need to move more towards that and understanding that. So, you know, there's this concept of running naked, which is running without a watch, and the fact that we have a name for it speaks to how rare it is and how important it probably is. So I think you've got people, I always joke about the Garmin Symphony. If you, once you go past the kilometer marker in a marathon, it's just like just cacophony of noise of people's watches pinging. So, I mean, we're probably a bit, endurance athletes are probably a bit obsessed about the metrics too much.
Very interesting. To go back to the rugby side and team sport aspect,
yep.
How would you, in an ideal world, say you had a sports scientist for every player on the field,
yep.
How can we better use GPS in that context? How do we categorize high speed running or high speed meters? What is the right way to approach that metric if we could do it perfectly?
In a perfect world, I'd probably look at percentage of max. So actually test these guys. So get them on a field, get them in rugby gear on a dry day and, you know, maybe even a wet day, and like get them to run maximally. And then you go, okay, well, this is max. So now let's look at percentages of max and where you spent your time. That's going to quantify it better. And that would be probably by positional group. So let's call it back three. Let's call it centers. Probably halves, back row, and then front five. So, or something like that. And you could just go, because positionally, it'll also depend a little bit on game plan. But now you're talking about people who are going to move similarly. Now we have roughly position specific norms based on everybody, like team, but then also individuals. And then we start to break it out to be more individual as to like, what was your load this week versus maximal, but also versus normal. Because ultimately it's about change in load that we're really concerned about. When we're talking about injury risks, it's not about what did you do? It's about what did you do with respect to what you can cope with. And then trying to quantify that, you know, in respect to like life stress, which is then it gets even murkier and harder, but you're bringing in metrics like HRV or POMS or all of the above, right, to try and understand that. And, you know, I remember as a younger coach working with a very experienced coach, and I was tracking all the stuff, looking at, you know, just using an arbitrary units measurement, how hard was a game out of 10, RPE over time. And I remember telling this coach, oh, this guy's a bit, you know, I'm a bit concerned about this guy because, you know, his RPE was really high this week. He goes, yeah, mate, but he says that every week. He just plays really hard. And I was like, oh, it's a really good point. And he's like, I'm really worried about that guy. And I was like, oh, but it was low this week. He's like, yeah, but he's struggling at home. And I was like, oh, well, all of a sudden I got this context from, you know, a very experienced coach who coached professionally when I was still, I was like 20 years old, trying to bring some sports science to a club rugby competition in Brisbane. So yeah, I learned good lessons there.
Yeah, I like the approach of the max anchoring that at the top and then working backwards. And like you said, you could probably establish some percentage zones based on different groups of athletes, based on levels too.
Yep.
Assuming, you know, higher level rugby players in that context would probably tolerate a higher density of high-speed running meters than somebody who is less of a training status. Let's move to, I guess, a derivative from heart rate, HRV.
Yep, big fan. I measure it multiple ways. Mm-hmm. I think it's overrated in the health and wellness community and underrated in the athletic community. So I think I see a lot of Goodhart's law sort of playing into the health and wellness community, where people are trying to use all number of things to improve their HRV, not understanding that HRV is is an indicator of stress. It's not the goal, right? So when the Goodhart's law is, when a measure becomes the goal, it ceases to be a good measure. And so I think they're trying to optimize HRV, which is not particularly hard to hack, let's be honest, via some breathing metrics. So you can certainly improve it. Whether that's meaningful in what you're trying to make HRV mean, I'm not convinced. So I think HRV is an indicator, it's not the goal. And so you need to live a life that facilitates a good HRV, not try and hack your way to a good HRV. And so I think that's the case. I think a lot of athletes don't like HRV because it doesn't do what they think they want it to do. So they want it to say, you can train hard today or you can't train hard today. Not, hey, you need to change some macro things. And the texture and the nuance in it is really hard to understand. Seasonal variance, stress around other things. So, you know, even the difference between overnight average, which is what most wearables are measuring, versus like, say, a morning sample, which is something like, you know, I use HRV for training. You know, even a morning sample is completely different to a night sample. Like I can do any number of things and get, you know, relatively okay or bad night values, and it's completely different in the morning. So what are you trying to make it mean? Are you trying to reflect your behaviors in the evening, which is an overnight average fundamentally? Or are you trying to look at, are you ready to absorb training that morning? In which case a morning sample probably makes more sense.
Yeah, I've used HRV for training for over a year every single day. Big fan of Marco's work. I had him on the podcast a long time ago. So I'd recommend anybody who wants an easy way to track that. That's also the other part is the convenience
Oh,
side,
yeah.
right? It's easier to just let your watch or your ring measure it through the night and then have a
Yep.
score when you wake up. It's a little more tedious to actually do the minute sampling in the morning. But then there's the other extreme as well. I've worked with some people here in nearby France. Somebody who has been for many years now at the top of the food chain when it comes to all the HRV research. But he had his I think it was Nordic Combine athletes. They would have to do something like, I think it took 10 minutes every single morning, and you did five
Yep.
minutes lying down, 5 minutes standing, and just the fatigue of that it generates of just people just don't want to do it. You know, it's
Yep.
such a heavy investment. Where's the right kind of equilibrium point, if there is one, to get the most useful data without it taking all day?
I mean, look, if you don't have space to do 1 minute measurement in the morning, we probably need to talk about your morning routine, like, and your life stress around that. And some people say, hey, I've got kids. And it's like, if you've got kids, like, cool, do an overnight average, fine, do your best there. Like, I get it. You know, that's hard. But if you, there's this classic, like, Buddhist saying is like, everyone should meditate for 10 minutes a day. And if you don't have time, then you should meditate for 20 minutes. Like, if we are at a stage in our lives where we can't spend the time to do this, then that's its own issue that you need to sort out, because that's going to be affecting your HRV more than the benefit of tracking it. So you probably need to sort that out. Does everyone need to track it? Certainly not. But if you're going to track it, then track it. I think there's some, I mean, look, Marco is a friend of mine. He's done some great writing on this topic. So like, go check out his Substack and his Medium and all his writing there. But I mean, there's some really interesting stuff around, as you said, sitting versus lying versus standing. And how do you do that? For me, for ease of it, I do sitting up in the morning. I get up, go to the toilet, grab my phone, sit down and do it, and just go for it. Do a minute there. You know, you fill out, he's got some subjective stuff, and then he gives you some advice from there. I track it. I'll be honest, I don't modify training a lot around it, because I found the things that impact my ability to adapt and my HRV both morning and evening are fundamentally work related. I can run a marathon, I can run an ultra marathon, I can do all sorts of training. I'm pretty fine. In fact, it's probably a little bit better. But if I drive for a long period of time, or I have a lot of meetings or something like that, then that cooks me the next day. So then it's about, and with that information, it's about engineering the life that facilitates not having that, right? So it's moving those things around so they're spread out, rather than having six in a row, because that's what really like affects me. And then travel, of course, which you have to travel or you don't have to travel. That's kind of what it boils down to.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Next, we're going to go power meter, overrated, underrated.
Underrated in, well, I don't know if you can underrate it in cycling. I mean, it's not overrated in cycling. I think in running, this is actually something I've changed my mind on. Until a little while ago, I was like, this isn't power. You're not measuring running power. This has no meaning. It's useless. Now, having understood a little bit more, it isn't power. And it's a number that translates to something like cycling power, gives you a similar sort of insight. And then there's some values to that. I think the proponents would say that it removes things like the noise in heart rate data. And I don't think that's noise. I think that's actually signal, right? If your heart rate is artificially high because it's hot, like that's actually helpful, not a burden. But I do think there's some value in it for some people pacing wise in running. And I think there's perhaps some values for some people who are, you know, especially in like a trail race, uphill versus flat. I'm still trying to understand if it's going to be good enough when it comes to weather, so like wind or something like that, because I don't know how well it takes that in. And I'll be honest, I haven't played with Stride. I've played with the Coros pod and that sort of thing, and I used it. The data didn't have significantly more meaning to me than pace did, but I was running fundamentally flat. And then there's all sorts of adjusted paces that you can get on watches now, which are pretty good as well for like height, for elevation gain. So if it's something that helps you and you can make sense of it, and you already understand cycling power, then I think it probably makes a ton of sense for you. I think, is it necessary? Not particularly. And then there's some really cool research that is infatuating me at the moment around understanding economy with shoes and different shoes. And Stride released, well, they haven't released some research. Some people released some research with a Stride monitor looking at choosing the right shoe for you based on economy, using running power only, not needing to use gases, which I think is quite cool. So I mean, there's certainly some value in it there. If you're a technophile and or you understand power, maybe it's underrated for you in running. For the rest of us, maybe not. I don't know. It's hard to know.
How about lactate?
I think for most people it's overrated because of the technicality and the and the amount of learning you need to do to make sense of it. And actually, shout out to you, your lactate article is really good on Thanks, your man. Website. It's I really enjoyed that. And I think it's a really good job of explaining it. But the nuance involved with lactate and the variables that come in and the challenges measuring it, like it's infinitely complex to a point where I think most people probably need to spend a lot of time and waste a lot of money on lactate strips to get to a point where they can do anything with it. And even then, I think the thought that it's just about intensity is probably, if that's what you think it is and you think it's going to help you find zones and stay at the right intensity, I think you probably should stay away from it.
I like so, it. Yeah. How about, and I know we're not quite there yet, but constant lactate monitoring.
I wrote an article on this on my Substack, actually. So I can send you that for the show notes. But the long and the short of it is, I think we're going to see similar to what we saw with continuous glucose monitors. They're going to come to the market. Everyone's going to be really keen. Everyone's going to get them. And there's going to be this like initial like wave of like all of the tech things are going to be writing about how good this is or how this is the new thing, all the blogs. Then there's going to be a bunch of people who do finger sticks versus their continuous lactate monitor and say they're not accurate. And then it's going to be a little while later when everyone starts to understand it. And I think it's going to, we're also going to see a spate of people who have a high lactate at rest that freak out or and are seeing values that they don't understand, right? And the corollary to this would be like seeing high glucose levels after you've eaten, people going like, oh, I've got diabetes. It's like, well, understanding like normal variation in this stuff is really important. And even like after I finished Berlin Marathon, I was wearing a continuous glucose monitor. My glucose ended up at a clinically hypoglycemic level. But I was fine. I was walking. I was happy, just talking. And I showed my father, who happens to be an ICU physician, and he was like, do we need to take you to hospital? And I was like, no, it's fine. This is normal. He's like, well, how is that normal? And I was like, well, how many glucose measurements have you seen in somebody who's upright and walking? I mean, with deals with ICU patients, most of them are intubated. They can't talk, let alone walk. So the context is so important. I think continuous lactate monitors are going to be, I'm actually pretty bullish on them, but it will be a long time. And I think having worked at these, you know, in some of these companies, I think the tech that gets built on top of it, the software that gets built on top of it is going to be the challenge. If you can get that product right, the rest of it will be fine, but there's going to be so much education needed. You know, I previously worked for a continuous glucose monitor company. I did a lot of the education. Like I basically had a job because of how complex it was. You're going to need like two or three of me for lactate because it's like, is high good? Is low good? When do you need this? Like, what about what I've eaten? When have I eaten? Like, what about my hydration levels? All that stuff. So I think I'm bullish on lactate, but it needs to be in context, probably with glucose, to be honest. I think if you have those two things and you understand some other variables, then it'll be pretty good. But otherwise, it's going to be a challenge.
I guess what comes to mind is, and I was going to get to that, muscle oximetry or tissue saturation. It's kind of the same thing. It's great. It's constant. You get, you know, two data points a second. Now devices give you 20, 50 a second, but that's that many more chances of not understanding what's coming out. When you get a lactate sample every 5 minutes, then you see a pretty curve and you see some changes and you see an evolution and you can infer what you want from that. But when you have something every single second, there's so many elements that come and influence that signal that, like you said, how do you make out the signal from the noise? And that's it seems to be a lot harder. And like you said, takes a lot of practice. If we went just a little bit deeper into that, can you talk, since you've written on it, you've worked on it, you probably know better than most, what the technical differences are in a lactate sample, say at the earlobe or at the finger, versus constant lactate monitoring? What are we measuring in each of those cases, and how is it different?
So there's, I mean, glucose and lactate in most of the fluids in the body. So you can measure it from tears if you want. You can measure it from sweat. And this is part of the sources of error, right? So now you've got sweat that contaminates your lactate sample you take at the finger or the earlobe. That's a problem. We also have lactate, you know, that can occur as a result of trauma to blood cells. So squeezing a finger, those sort of things. So there's all sorts of these errors. But in short, you are measuring at earlobe or finger, you're measuring capillary, right? So a small blood vessel, lactate. Or glucose. With a continuous glucose or lactate monitor, they're going to sit in the interstitial fluid, which is the fluid between the blood and the muscle cell or the whatever cells, which may reflect better the muscle. I don't know. But the problem we have is that we have so much data on the other stuff. And so the kinetics and the kinematics of those are different. They move differently. They behave differently. So all of our understanding has been through the lens of blood. And so you can't take that lens and apply it to something else. That's like saying, you know, it's like, everything you know is about an orange, and now you're trying to evaluate a banana through the lens of an orange. It's not going to work for you. It's different, right? So there's that component. it's certainly going to be, there could be sources of error. I mean, another thought is that these use reactants. So all of them use reactants, which is to say that glucose or lactate will react with something that is on the strip or in the monitor. And there are things that can cross-react with that. So classically with continuous glucose monitors, you have like vitamin C cross-reacts with glucose oxidase, which is the enzyme there. So if you take vitamin C, you can see this artificially high glucose. So there is those sources of error. But probably the big one for lactate more than glucose, I would say, is that lactate is constantly produced at all times and constantly used at all times and to differing amounts, right? And so fundamentally, when we see an accumulation, we're seeing excess production versus with respect to utilization. But it is utilized everywhere, not just in working muscle and those sort of things. So when you're sampling at a finger or you're sampling an earlobe, those two things aren't even the same. If you get the same sample at the same time, they're not even going to be the same because you've got different metabolism between where it's produced and then where it's sampled. And the same will be true for probably the back of the arm where these continuous lactate monitors will go. So I think all of those things mean that it's going to be, it's, I would say if you're going to use these things, you need to understand lactate and almost not, like not use that knowledge a little bit or not use the knowledge you have of the samples, or you do both for a while and understand them in like context together. So spend a month where you're wearing a continuous lactate monitor and doing a lot of finger streaks. So you're starting to understand the variance between them and you can contextualize your continuous lactate monitor through the lens you already understand, which is through blood.
So putting your current understanding aside temporarily in order to essentially be able to use that new perspective and have an open mind when you approach that data and not apply your preconceived notions about it.
Or use the preconceived stuff to contextualize your new right. stuff. But yeah. all with the thought, and I would say this of continuous glucose monitor as well, all with the thought that what you're seeing is normal, not abnormal. Mm-hmm. Unless you're certain, like, you know, if you have diabetes, of course, okay, it's a little bit different. But for the most part, most athletes probably don't have diabetes. So if or don't have a problem with their lactate system. So let's assume that you're normal and what we're seeing is normal. And work from that standpoint, and we may be proven wrong, but rather than assuming that we're going to be, you know, assuming that you're going to have a lactate that is low, let's say assuming it's going to be 0.1 or 0.2 or something at rest, like it's probably a fallacy. It's probably not going to be that at rest if you sample it. So don't be scared if it's a little bit higher.
Okay. Another field you worked in extensively, like you just mentioned, constant glucose monitors.
Yeah. What about
what are your thoughts on that?
I think really useful if you have a question to answer, and really useful. I think they'll actually be made more useful by continuous lactate monitors. I think having that understanding, because of course lactate can be converted to glucose. And so understanding all those things, I think is really important. I mean, we were doing some research at the company I was at. We had some really cool research on some stuff that had come out, and it was, you know, it was just getting exciting. Unfortunately, the company's now ceased to be in existence, but, you know, like, I learned a lot from them. I found great use in them. I think they will continue to be very useful, but like the challenge is always going to be, I mean, data frequency is probably the biggest difference in the market and the biggest challenge. 15-minute data points look nothing like 1-minute data points to your, you know, your muscle oxygenation thing. And I'm not even convinced 1 minute is better than 2 minutes, to be honest. I think there's a lot of noise in 1-minute data that may be, when you measure it like that, you're expected to explain it all. And I'm not convinced that that's the best. It might be better to be a little bit lower res on it, but it's hard to know. I think we've seen some really cool data, some really interesting stuff. Like we've seen elite athletes who can hold glucose levels that are super high for a long time without too much intake. You know, so this, you know, I've seen people hold glucose well above 200 milligrams per deciliter, which is well above 11 millimole for hours. And hours, right? And just that understanding. And, you know, I showed that to medical colleagues of mine. They'd be like, oh, does this person have diabetes? It's like, no, this is an elite athlete. You know, he's got a body fat percentage of less than 10. Like this, very unlikely this person has diabetes. So just that re-understanding of it. And I think that's going to be, I think that has a lot of value to the people who do have diabetes, because understanding what people without diabetes, like their glucose kinetics, changes the way you may think about managing diabetes, because now you have a different lens on it. But again, so much of our lens and our understanding of glucose has been through diabetes and through blood. And now we have interstitial glucose in people without diabetes. And it's like, it completely changes it. And understanding that's really hard.
Did you know that I've recently started an all English YouTube channel? If you're not following me there yet, please take a few seconds to go subscribe to the Upside Strength English channel and get access to hundreds of hours of free content. It's definitely something we'll come back a little bit later to. And it makes me think of the conversation I had with Inigo San Milan, where he sees both extremes of the spectrum in terms of, you know, metabolic dysfunction and metabolic health is a big word, performance or hyper optimization with the elite athletes. And as you're saying here, maybe having a better perspective on that spectrum can help us understand those different states and what we can do better at either end, I guess.
Well, I think it's actually quite interesting. Like the difference between severe like disease metabolism and exercise metabolism, like the metrics look pretty similar. Like if I was to show you a bunch of metrics from somebody who's just finished a marathon, you'd think they're very sick.
Yeah.
So that's a really interesting point, and it's a really interesting corollary to draw. And it's something I picked up pretty early in medicine. I was like, oh, it's like his lactate values are high and the glucose is high and blood pressure's, I'm like, kind of looks like a marathon. So it's certainly, there are some parallels to think about there, but you know, even if you want to start thinking about, you know, concepts of things like hormesis, it's like, well, maybe this helps us be able to tolerate being severely unwell if that happens to happen to us for whatever reason, right? Maybe that's why fitness reduces all-cause mortality, because even if you get severely sick, your physiology is a bit more used to dealing with that.
Which does make a lot of sense. And I know that there's something also to the extent of, I spoke of it with a good friend. Maybe that's the first podcast you need to listen to in French. It's one with my friend Vincent, who's an elite indoor rower and also a researcher in his own right. And he was talking about the importance of lactate exposure to cells and how that can have positive effects on the cancer mitigation and those considerations. So like you said, kind of prepping the body to face those stresses if and when they come. It's a very interesting thought. And back to what you were saying before, you look at somebody's lactate after a marathon, it looks like somebody's sick. Yeah, the big difference is somebody just ran a marathon, the other one's just sitting there. And that should say a lot about, you know, the importance of that first state that we talked about.
Yeah, for sure. 100%. And the context is important, right? In the data, always. Like, it only takes you so many times to get caught out being shown data and misinterpreting it as a young, insert here, coach, doctor, whatever, to understand context is important.
Absolutely. I've got a couple more metrics for you. First one or next one would be muscle oximetry, overrated, underrated.
I'm super, it's an area I need to work on. So I'm going to say it's underrated because I haven't done a lot with it. Everything I'm seeing in terms of like intensity control, even I had a friend recently, she's an elite triathlete, was really struggling on her race bike. She was struggling on race day. She's does 70.3 triathlons, would get off the, like, would cycle terribly, low power, feel like real heavy legs, feel like she was pushing it, get off, run terribly, couldn't understand it. And I said to her, can you just get a muscle oximetry and just check your bike position? Because she had no issues on her gravel bike. And then lo and behold, muscle oximetry was super low when she was in her time trial position. So I was like, well, you're occluding something somewhere, fix your position. And all of a sudden she was like, oh, Jesus, feels way better. And I was like, well, you know, so I think probably underrated because I don't have enough insight into it and it's somewhere I want to go. But all of the signal I'm seeing from people I respect, you know, including yourself, I've got your Moxie episode downloaded. Awesome. That I've listened to most of and I'm going to re-listen to again. So I think, is it worth the expense? It's a hard question to answer. And maybe it isn't for some people, but I think by virtue of where we're headed with tech, like this stuff will get cheaper and smaller. And I think once it's smaller and cheaper, once it's not going to torch all of your tights because you have to slit it under your tights or whatever, once we're at that stage, I think it's probably going to be very, very useful. And it's probably going to replace lactate in many senses because of the things you've mentioned.
Next, I want to talk about ventilation.
So an article that's coming out of my Substack in the next little while and somewhere I've noticed you posting about the last couple of days is like these ventilation shirts. And I am like, I think this is the wearable I'm most excited about because I think ventilation probably gives us more insight than many of these metrics that we've talked about. And probably a lot of what we make those mean actually has better signal from ventilation. So again, clinically in medicine, if you speak to good doctors, they'll all tell you a good ventilation measure is much more indicative of things than a lot of like heart rate and stuff that we tend to look at more closely. It's just that ventilation's done pretty poorly in the hospitals because you 30 second average or whatever, and then you multiply that by two or whatever. So point being, I think ventilation is fascinating. I think it gives great insight into different, arousal states, into recovery, even all those things. I mean, I just spent some time at altitude, like I didn't get a ventilation measure, but I can tell you it was up. You know, so all those things, I think it's probably the better, a better way to do thresholding. Like if we're talking about trying to understand physiological zones, ventilation makes more sense to me than anything else. Mm-hmm. Maybe lactate, but again, you got to get good samples there. Whereas ventilation's pretty, like pretty easy to see.
Yeah, it's accessible. And like you said, the shirt, it was my first time using it a couple of days ago on the bike. I did the shirt Time Wear for those who are interested, TYME. And I had the VO2 Master on as well because I wanted to see what does it look like frequency wise, volume wise. And I was surprised by how close it is. And I think the extremes were a little bit smoother on the shirt, but I believe there's the smoothing that's applied in the software and you can modify that on the raw data on the back end. From what I heard, shout out to Johnny Whale who helped me a little bit understand that. But it was pretty impressive given it's literally just a shirt that you wear and that it's going to give you your frequency with high accuracy. And the volume was especially surprised about how accurate the volume was. That being said, it's their own arbitrary unit and it's not a volume in liters like you might get with a mask. But what I'm looking into is, can you convert one to the other? As in, if I have the baseline with the VO2 Master, can I then convert my my shirt data? And like you said, I think that's extremely interesting moving forward. It's very easy to implement, right? There's not no calibration. Just put it on and go do your thing. And in contests, like, and I know we've talked about this a little bit off air, respiratory training, I think that's one way of quantifying things that you can't do with the mask. Because if you need to have a device in your mouth to breathe with or through, that limits it right away. So I'm pretty excited about that as well.
I also think, I mean, one of the things to note with all of these things, if you are, because they're not calculating respiration, right? Let's be really clear. They are not calculating it. What they are measuring is chest expansion. Mm-hmm. So understanding that, they then have to convert it into things like volumes or numbers. And so whenever you have something like that, where you have measured versus like calculated or reported, you're going to have smoothing, you have algorithms, all that stuff. And it's never going to function as well at the extremes. Mm. And that speaks to athletes as well, right? Yeah. So if you have Christian Blumenfeld's a good example, like his lung volumes are going to, like, they're not going to be reported well on any wearable because they're so abnormal. They're so much bigger than everyone else's because of his chest wall. So just understanding that, again, speaks to like the thin slicing that you need to take to understanding all tech, but certainly things once you go to the field.
Two more for you, last two. First one, I've heard you speak about briefly. I'm interested in your opinion on that because I've changed my stance on it. DFA Alpha 1.
Yeah, I was super bullish on this, mostly because of Marco's stuff. And he built an app for it. I went and ran with it. I found it to be helpful in that respect, but I probably changed my mind on it. Like I don't know if it really added a lot to me. I was like bullish on it, trying to tell me first threshold really is like, can I be under first threshold? But probably less bullish on it now. Data's looking less good. I don't have the app anymore. So like that probably speaks enough to it and I don't use it anymore. So even with how good Marco was at building things and how easy that was to use, it was just a little bit clunky for me because I had to do averages of this amount of time. And it was just never... It was hard for me to pinpoint. I probably should have done it on a treadmill, to be honest, but I like running outside too much, but I found it hard to find a good pace there that was better than intrinsic feeling.
Yeah. Well, one thing that unfortunately kind of ruined it for me was, to our prior point, is the impact of breathing on that signal. I just sitting at, constant wattage on the bike and just looking at the signal and then playing with hypoventilation and hyperventilation and just be able to literally just up and down the signal over a few seconds. And I've heard some people in that space say, it's a feature, not a bug. There's that tight link between the two. We know that the way you breathe is going to influence cardiac dynamics and that DFA alpha 1 is it's a signal from that space. But for me, the influence of one on the other, just you can't control for the latter. So I'm unconvinced after being very excited about it, like you probably were at the beginning. But I'm open if something comes down the line, maybe why not? But now,
I think we both would love it to work for what we're using it for. But I think even whether it's feature or noise, it's enough that it can't be used for what we're trying to use it for. Because then that's on us, right? Then it's, hey, this is a feature. and we're trying to make it mean something it doesn't mean. Okay, well then I don't want to use it for that. Like, and then I see no value in using it then. Like, whether it's feature or noise, it means that I can't use it for what I want to use it for.
Mm-hmm. Last but not least on my list, RPE.
Underutilized, like underrated everywhere. I just think, yes, it takes some dialing in. It certainly does, particularly for people who are new. I think you need to dial that in, and maybe, you know, every now and again they say you got to go see God, right? In a workout, as like, you know, a minute assault bike sprint or something to really understand what a 10 is, perhaps. I do think, and it's something I've taken from Olav Alexander Bu, for those familiar, like a two-dimensional model, understanding that duration is so relevant in RPE, because to say my RPE is 10, like, what does that mean? Is that intensity, or is that intensity duration mix? And I think understanding that it's intensity duration mix and starting to put texture to that is super, is probably more valuable. So understanding, like, if you say 10, that means that, like, you can't continue. You know, it might be 9, but, you know, I can continue for a while. But just understanding that, and maybe it speaks to durability as a physiological parameter as well. But certainly I finish a marathon unable to give any more, and at most points in that marathon, my RPE is quite low. And that doesn't make a lot of sense if you're using a single number, right? And not using a context of duration.
Yeah.
My pacing, you know, in London, I paced pretty much even. I went out to run 2:42. I ran 2:42. I pretty much evenly split, maybe a negative split of like a few seconds. So like, it couldn't have been better. And it's fundamentally a flat marathon. Like, that is, if you looked at a physiology textbook, you'd be like, okay, well, this RPE should go up over time. It actually didn't. It was very low for a large portion of it. And then it started to creep up really quickly. And then it was high for a while. And then it probably, you know, as I sprinted across the line, it was super high. And then it was fine. And I felt fine afterwards, walked away, felt fine afterwards, right? And the RPE gets really complex when you start to add long durations. When you're talking about, you know, let's call it up to say the 3,000 meters on the track. So let's talk 9 minutes. It's probably good as a single digit. But once you get beyond that and there's a huge aerobic component, durability probably comes into it. And then we probably need a second like dimension of RPE where it's a duration time as well, a duration sort of anchor as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. I recently spent quite a bit of time digging into all the research that's been done around RPE, and I was surprised. I knew it held a lot. I mean, it was high in my esteem already, but now it's kind of transcended everything else, and it's easily at the top of the pyramid. If I had to pick one kind of conversation, it's actually surprisingly robust, right? Because I mean, surprisingly, from the standpoint that we've been instilled that subjective is not as accurate as objective, and that it's just your sensations and you can't trust what you feel and you have to look at objective data. And that's probably one of the biggest load of bullcrap that we've been fed over the last few years is, you know, and what you've said, what I see now is, and I work a lot in the CrossFit space, and especially with those, with that demographic, we see just people that are anesthetized, where if they don't feel dead, they don't feel anything. And they're incapable of making out a 4 from a 5. And I was for the longest time as well, right? Because until you try and until you spend the time and you have that introspective kind of perspective on yourself, you just don't get much out of it. And I think it's something that kids should learn in school, you know, how to listen to the signals that your body sends you. The quote that I always like to bring up is the Niels van der Poel one. In his training manual, he said, and I'm probably going to misquote him, but go read the manual for those who are interested. You have to listen to your body whisper so you don't have to hear it scream. And that's something that's so important.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of reward in our world for not listening to your body. Like most successful people I know are self-sacrificial in many ways, be that they can push through pain athletically, they can sacrifice their health for business success, all those things. So I think there's a lot of reward for anesthetizing yourself, so to speak, in our society, and we're rewarding it. But if you want to talk about understanding performance over a duration, a timeline that is not measured in weeks, RPE makes the most sense. It makes the most sustainable sense to really dial that in and get it. And it's, if you think about it, you've got a supercomputer sitting between your ears, some more super than others. And it is taking all of the signals, which we can measure and not measure, and giving you an output as a single number. Like, that's like pretty amazing stuff. And you know, any good coach, right? Because there's this art versus science debate, right? Or science versus practice, or whatever you want to call it. But all of the good coaches, be they science-based or not, will tell you the best barometer of how someone is going is ask them how they're going. Now, Alex Ferguson used to have an office that overlooked the Man United car park, so you could see how they got out of the car there are all these stories. You talk to any good coaches at any good clubs, they'll all tell you, like, I say hello to everybody so I can see how they're going. Mm-hmm. You know, we look at how they're feeling, we look at body language, all this stuff gives you an indication. And it's super important because, you know, I have an article that dropped 2 hours ago with ideas that need to die. And one of them is that the mind and the body are separate. And like, it just isn't. They're the same. Like, they're the same thing. There's this debate in medicine between like the brain and the mind, psychology versus neurology. And there's this like conflict. They're the same. Like, it's just the biggest, one of the most limiting beliefs we have is that they are not the same thing. That, and you know, we dismiss it as placebo, or we say that person's a head case or whatever. Like, it's just not fair. And it's not the case. We need to be, you know, some of the best coaches in the world are the best psychologists in the world. You know, the rest of it, like the X's and O's, like when we're young coaches, we love it. We love the merits of reps of six versus reps of five. And then you get to a stage where you're like, oh, none of this actually matters. And then you get to a stage where you're like, all the psychology matters and the rest of it's absolute noise. And like, go do whatever you want, as long as, you know, we can get you psychologically happy and working as a unit, whatever that looks like.
Yeah. And it's hard. I remember back to when I was doing a lot more in-person coaching, personal training, and, you know, oh, how many reps should I do? Well, just go until it gets pretty hard and then you stop. And then we're going to do it again a few times. And then next week we'll do a couple reps more and we'll just keep going like that in a very nonchalant way. But they don't like that. They want a number. They want to know, is it 14 reps? Is it 15 reps? Why are you not counting? You have to count.
Yeah. Well, that comes like Andy Galpin's like chef, baker, cook analogy, like comes to mind there. I just, mm-hmm. and you got to know who you're working with, right? Are you working with a chef, baker, or a cook? And I tend to prefer to work with chefs these days. Like high level oversight, you need to modify it yourself. Give me feedback. We can tweak it. We can have a discussion and agree on something, mm-hmm. rather than working with bakers who are like, I need to know every detail. Cause I used to be a baker. I'm a type A personality. I see a lot of myself in them, and you want them to get to a stage where they don't worry about the detail because you know that their physiological arousal and their stress levels will be better for it. But to have that conversation almost guarantees disengagement from them. So, you know, you're going to fail getting into that almost. It's just like, it's really hard.
For those that are interested in this idea of RPE and listening to oneself a little bit more, what advice could you give them in light of everything we've just talked about, looking at different, you know, wearables, data, RPE? How can we get better at feeling what is going on?
So first thing I'd say is the wearable will affect how you feel, right? So there's good research. I mean, there's a thing called orthosomnia where like the worry about sleep trackers worsens your sleep. It's a known thing that they talk about in literature, that we're going to get more of that and more of that. There's certainly this in running. You'll go out, feel like you have a good run, and you look at your watch pace and you're like, oh, it was terrible. And conversely, when you feel good and your pace is slow, like that messes with you mentally. So, you know, Alex Hutchinson's book on this is great. If you haven't read Endure, go read Endure.
It's amazing.
But so firstly, I would say is, under, if you're trying to dial this in, go feeling first, then objective. So one, like, so the first one you need to look at or think about is your feeling. Don't be influenced the other way. Second thing I'd say is calibrate it. So go do a 10, like go see what 10 is. Like absolutely couldn't do a minute more. I said a minute on the assault bike, something like that. Like that's 10. Now you have a 10. Now think about that when you're starting to say like, oh, this is a 6. Like maybe it isn't a 6, you know? So understand that as the second thing. So you need to calibrate all those things. And then just, you need to practice it. Just like anything. Like you didn't get good at insert whatever here on day one. It has to take time. And again, we've anesthetized ourselves, but you certainly have feedback mechanisms, right? That can give you that as well. So I would certainly do that as well. So yes, wearables help, but they help for feedback. It's like, did I sleep well? Yeah, I did. What does my wearable say? Well, it says I only woke up a couple of times. Okay, that's probably like probably reasonable then. Or like it says I woke up a ton of times. Well, is that really accurate? What? How does it measure my wake ups? Oh, it only just measures HRV and movement. Okay, well, maybe that was a dream. Maybe it was a bad dream or something like that. So just understanding that.
Another area I'm interested in, and I'd like your thoughts on it, is AI and how do you see AI influencing or disrupting coaching, training? What areas are going to be affected the most? Is it what people, you know, usually think about, or is it in different ways that it's going to be impacted?
I think the first thing that's going to happen is like a bunch of people who you like, and I don't want to talk badly about these people. It just, these people exist. Like they do very similar programming for mass amounts of people. I think that's going to die. I think AI is going to take over that, and like platforms will just kill that off. I think it's going to change the role of a coach away from the X's and O's to more the psychology, emotional aspects of it. And that more soft skills of coaching and helping with decision-making, more of a consultant sort of standpoint. I think that's going to be the case. And I think in many aspects of the world as well. Like you're going to see this real separation. What was probably more of a spectrum is going to be real, like a lot more polarization there for people where like the bottom end of that scale is probably going to lose jobs, whereas the top end is probably going to be more valuable. I also think it's going to take a lot of, it's probably going to get closer to RPE, to be honest, in that respect, in that we're going to be able to pull a bunch of metrics together and see some stuff. And where it's going to be a real challenge, and this is somewhere I've had to check myself multiple times, actually in a conversation 2 days ago, is models and AI and all of these things that we build, they don't care about physiology. They don't understand physiology and they don't use physiology. They use numbers. And that's super important to understand, because if it says this and your physiological understanding is different, it doesn't matter. The physiology lens limits you. Because I speak to mathematicians about this stuff and they tell you, and they're like, oh, this is the prediction. I'm like, no, but that's wrong because of this physiology. It's like, well, no, it's right, because that like the algorithm or the whatever the computation says that, and you need to throw away, like you need to, or at least hold back your understanding of physiology that's going to limit your belief in that respect. Because I think if you want to truly embrace it, you have to, you know, and maybe it's wrong, right? And don't misunderstand what I'm saying, which is to say, you know, sometimes these things will be wrong, but you will be proven wrong by a prediction from AI or an algorithm at some point, which doesn't make physiological sense or in the way you think about it. And that is because, yeah, it doesn't need to understand physiology. It doesn't have those same limitations that we do, right? So like they always say that, you know, the same mind that creates a problem can't solve the problem. Like, you know, it's a different thing that's solving the problem in a different way. So your understanding is limited. It's not that model won't work.
Hey, real quick, I've prepared a free mini course to help you understand everything that you absolutely need to know on training zones, how to train zone 2 for your sport, and how to organize your endurance training in general. You can sign up for free using the link in the description. Let's talk about some application. We had a couple of good questions on Instagram when I said that you were coming over on the podcast. One was testing for different endurance athletes. So let's put all those wearables and metrics that we just discussed in practice.
Yep.
How do you approach testing for endurance athletes, and maybe give us two or three different cases that you're familiar with? It's, you know, running, cycling, triathlon, and the specific demands of those disciplines.
Yeah, I tend to use a skill lens, which is sounds weird for an endurance sport, but I think it's underdone there. So understanding that, let's use a marathon because it's what I spent half the episode talking about. Apologies. It's where my head's at as an athlete. So the marathon isn't just about the physiology. It's not about having a high lactate threshold and a good running economy. Those things are important, but it's about being able to go from the start line to the finish line in as quick as possible time, which has components of physiology and pacing, which is a skill, fueling, which is a skill, race tactics, which is a skill. Do I go with the pack? Do I stay without the pack? It's windy. Should I sit in? How do I do a negative split? What are the course constraints? You know, we just saw Boston Marathon. Almost everyone blew up on the hills, you know, of course, because that happens every time, right? It's just at the hard time. So understanding that all those factors play in. So addressing all of those and ensuring that they can execute on race day is probably what, like the goal metric, breaking that down and making sure that we touch on all those things that are not going to be touched on by the physiology, right? So we're going to condition you physiologically, but we need to make sure that you can fuel properly. So where are we building that in? We're going to talk race strategy. We're going to talk, how do we deal with that? Making good decisions around winds, et cetera, weather, all those things, adjusting pacing strategies in the heat. What are we doing for cooling? If it's hot, can we grab ice cubes and hold them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I won't labor the point. Then when it comes to testing, it's like, where are we and where do we need to get to? Or where are we hoping to get to? I tend to use an extensification rather than an intensification for people. So I tend to like think about it that way and look at where they are and then try and extend that using like super Renato Canova inspired type of marathon sessions and really building towards that, I guess, what is effectively durability. So in someone like myself, standardly, I'll build up from goal marathon pace. I'll have an idea what I want to run, and then I'll build that up from, you know, 3 kilometers, like, you know, multiple reps of 3 kilometers to 4 kilometers, 5 kilometers, up to 3 sets of 10 kilometers. So 2 weeks out of a marathon, I'm doing three sets of 10 kilometers at marathon pace with a kilometer between those that's a little bit shorter, and a jog warm up and jog cool down. So we're talking 38 kilometers, 30 of it at marathon pace. So when it gets to marathon day, it's like, I know exactly what I'm going to run because I've just done something like that on heavy legs, you know, all going well, I can execute on race day. So I tend to sort of use that, reverse engineer, look for deficits, address a deficit in a general phase, then extensify in the specific phase and go that way. So in terms of testing, mostly it's about running. Can you run fast enough for a duration, right? And like, yes, we use heart rate to corroborate, like, you know, anyone can eke out, you know, I can run that rep at that pace, sure, but like your heart rate's 190, it's probably not helpful. That's probably not a good representation. And in that case, maybe depending on athlete type, you might decide, let's go do a bunch of time trials. Let's do a 5K, 10K, half marathon, see where you're at and see where we need to address it from there. Recently spoke to somebody, a HYROX athlete actually. And I mean, that's a really fascinating case because it's a known quantity. I heard your conversation with Hunter and really enjoyed that actually.
Thanks.
But yeah, it's a really known quantity. So now, yes, of course, you can break each of the individual implements down or into the individual stations and the running down. And you also need to be able to execute for an hour at relatively high intensity, hour and five, hour and 10, wherever you are. But then you need to start piecing that together. So it's all good to say I can run 10 by a kilometer in 3 minutes a kilometer. But what about after a bunch of lunges or after some reverse sled or that sort of thing? And then understanding the skill. I mean, Hunter spoke to the running that's in between the implement and the start of the kilometer, like, because it's not a kilometer, right? It's from the end of your station to the start of the kilometer. Like, you know, so all of those little things to reverse engineer that. But I think the most important test is always your previous event, highlighting weaknesses, highlighting points of need. You address those in the preseason or the off season or the early phase, and then you build through a specific prep for the thing that's required. Again, working general to specific is always how I go. So in an early phase of my marathon blocks, it'll always be specific VO2 max type work, or traditionally what is called that, traditionally what is called threshold work. And then we move into a more marathon specific stuff, which is, you know, just working on effectively durability if we use a physiology lens. But all of this is a skill lens for me. I need to be faster, I need to be able to, you know, sustain this. And then I need to work towards running that pace at an extended period of time with fueling on a, you know, at the same time of day, whether I've eaten breakfast or not, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, with caffeine. So
for the running, I'll let you continue. For the others just after, I like your contextual approach of, like you said, looking at what is going on race day, what is needed on race day and everything that it involves. Because I think we can easily get stuck in the data and the physiology and quantifying this and not then thinking of its application. I guess it's a test in the lab or an isolated physiological test is very much just a snapshot in a given context, and it's rarely done in the context of the competition itself. So it's almost, it's not a one-to-one between the two, far from it. You can definitely, it doesn't mean it's not useful, right? Because it does mean you have a controlled environment, so you can test, retest, and see how things evolve over time. But you can't just say, okay, that's my lactate test, so that's going to be my pace. That's going to be my exactly. thing on the road.
Yeah, I have a close friend who's a very good runner. He has a lot of cramping problems. Like, he has the physiological capacity to run 219, a 219 marathon. Never broken 220. Just keeps having cramps. So like, until he can sort that out, and I'm not talking, it's like not a small thing. It's not like it's not that he's not conditioned. It's not that he hasn't gone and sort this out. He has done more work on cramping than a lot of people I know, but he can't solve it. And until he can solve it, he can't run 220 or sub 220. Right. So like, that's the end of the story. It doesn't matter about his physiology. He could be physiologically ready to run 205. If he cramps, it doesn't matter. He can't do it. So it's about crossing the finish line first. And so I would use that context always. But yeah, so testing, I think physiology and how you test people is about what they're trying to get out of it and how you may not need to do much testing, to be honest. Because if they can tell you where they're deficient and you know how to solve that problem and you have indicators that will tell you if that's solved, then you go from there. I think this thought that everyone needs to go to a physiology lab, get your, you know, thresholds done and then get your VO2 max done, like, it's fine if you want to do that and you enjoy it and you want to track it and that has meaning for you, but there are many better ways to do it, right? So, you know, in a triathlon context, if you're struggling with the run, is it that you overbiked? Is it that you can't run off the bike? Because those things are not to do with your physiological, like, it's not really that physiological, to be honest. It's about positions and it's about skills and it's about, you know, intensity control and execution and pacing. It's not really a physiology problem. So I tend, as I said at the very start of this, I use a skill lens fundamentally, but if you can address the deficits, if you can highlight them without a lab, you don't need to do a lot of testing. If an athlete said to me, I'm unconstrained by money, I'll happily do as much testing as possible and use as many wearables as you'd like. What would you like and when would you like it? Is probably a better way, or is a different way to answer this question. I would say that provided you as the coach and they, as the athlete, have the time to dig into all of the stuff. And it's a net positive, not a net negative, because you made a really good point about your colleague who measures HRV. Like, at some point, wearing all these things gets to be a burden. Even for someone like me who does this, it's kind of my shtick. It's kind of what I enjoy doing. It gets to be burdensome for me as well. And there is times where I run with like without even heart rate and just go and just run. And so provided you can do that, then I think there's value in probably having good metrics on sessions that are above first threshold. And then good metrics is about how many you're willing to test and measure and take. Probably not worth wearing a VO2 mask for those sessions, because they're pretty unpleasant, to be completely honest. Maybe it's worthwhile getting a sample at a certain time to understand some stuff, but I mean, it gets technical and there's lots of sources of error there. But I'd certainly recommend heart rate for a lot of it, just to really understand one internal metric of work that goes with an external metric of work. So pace, power, an internal metric is helpful as a kind of minimum that I'd recommend for most people. And then from there, it's about addressing specific deficits you may or may not have, right? So you might want to use, if you're struggling with your RPE and you are struggling with understanding your thresholds, maybe you use a muscle oximetry. If you're struggling with, and you know, that's probably on a low intensity session, not a high intensity session, but if you're looking at a peripheral limitation, you may use that for a higher intensity session. Mm. So it'll all be about understanding the rate limiter and then addressing that. And even again, in an endurance context, one of your rate limiters may be peripheral adaptation. I work with, you know, a couple of guys who are ex-Ironman or ex-cyclists who are now running. It's like their limitation's not central. They've got a Corvette engine in an absolute mini chassis. They don't, like, tendons and joints can't handle this. So the limitation's got nothing to do with physiology. It's, I mean, it does, but it's not it's not cardiovascular physiology. It is all musculoskeletal physiology. So, you know, you have to expose them to that and then get the stimulus elsewhere, get them to cycle hard and go do their thing with their friends. And then when they're running low intensity so they can condition the tendons, muscles, etc.
Yeah, I'm probably going to put myself out of work by saying that, but because I do a lot of physiological testing, especially, yeah, like I said, CrossFit, endurance sports. But the more I move forward, the more I see it as a, almost more of an education session, right? For people to understand how those things work at a base level. And sometimes that can help create buy-in from what I've seen.
Massively.
So they accept what we actually prescribe afterwards. But like you said, if you ask the right questions, I mean, based on the questionnaire that they fill out before we do the test, and based on what they're good at, what they're less good at, what they've done a lot, what they haven't done, what they prefer doing or not, I kind of know where things are going to fall. And then the data just comes to confirm what we knew from the information we had prior. And obviously it objectivizes things and it puts numbers on different aspects. And I love Steven Seiler's 3P model. So performance, yeah, physiology, perception. So trying to triangulate with all of those. And if you have you're on a bike, you have a power metric, you have a power data, you have the heart rate, lactate, muscle oximetry, and then you also have your RPE. And if you have all three, you're golden. You don't need much, yep, more than that. That's as much as you're going to need to triangulate and make sure things are going well. So I definitely converge with the way that you see things on, yeah, the testing side.
And some of it's personality, context type. Like, so using, I know you're a fan of Lionel Sanders, and, you know, he famously stopped using lactate or whatever.
Yeah.
Some of that's, I spent a bit of time with a Norwegian triathlete. It's like some of that is contextually dependent. There were no GPS watches in Kenya until a little while ago. Those guys were still the top 100 marathoners in the world, probably came from Kenya and still probably do, regardless of GPS watch or not. None of those Kenyans know their lactates. None of them have had a VO2 max test. Like, you know, it's not necessary nor sufficient, but it may help, and it may help understanding, and it may help culturally. And there may be a reason that you want to do it culturally, and it may help. And it's athlete dependent as well, athlete type, all those things. And maybe it helps to calibrate. Maybe it helps, because the athlete can't explain to you what his deficit is, and they're, or she, and then you test them and you go, hey, it's here. And then again, getting them to buy in, and sometimes getting them to buy in because you know what it is, they don't believe you, they don't agree, and then they get the testing and now it's, hey, you actually do need to do a lot of lower intensity stuff, because like this first threshold is very low. We need to compress that up to the second threshold a little bit. So let's work on that. So sometimes it's proving a point or buy-in or all those things. So there are reasons you do it. And this is, again, the art of coaching, not the science of it. The science of it says test everybody and then prescribe based on that. I tend to agree with you. I think your point around knowing what they're good at by what they enjoy and what they, so understanding their physiological profile by what they enjoy and what they do a lot of and what they're good at. There was a period of time when I was training and I used to have a day where I did only stuff I hated. in the gym, and I got so strong so quick. It was all the stuff I hated doing. It was obviously where I was like bad at it or mechanically disadvantaged or like deficit, and I just got so strong. It's yeah, it's something I'm gonna probably bring back to some of my training, is like, let's do all the stuff on one day that I hate that I need to do, right? Ankle mobility and whatever else, because that's then gonna set you up really well. But it also psychologically, it's a lot easier for me to go like, today's the day, and I gotta like, I'm gonna be pushing shit uphill, and like, that's okay. Today's gonna be a really bad day, and there's something nice about having one day that's terrible, and you're just like, here we are.
I guess that goes back to something Alex Hutchinson said when I had him on the podcast, is, you know, the best training is the one you've never done. The best stimulus is the one you've never had. And we often forget that as a lever for progress.
We're
so stuck in our specificity kind of bubble. And if we just went outside of that for a little bit and worked on something maybe unrelated, maybe on paper that has nothing to do with what you're supposed to be doing, oftentimes, especially if you've neglected those things for a long time, that pays huge dividends.
Yeah, and I think that's also how we can see people often evangelizing certain training programs that they've changed to, when they didn't realize that it's like the program is what it is. It's just the change that's been helpful, be it that they've never done that before, or just the change of stimulus. And then conversely, not sitting with that stimulus for long enough is also a problem. Like a close friend of mine, just strength and conditioning coach with the UFC, he like, yeah, we used to joke, he has like programming ADHD. Like he would be new program every 2 weeks. And I conversely was the opposite. I was like, no, 10-week program, and we're sticking to this.
Yeah.
I will cross the T's and dot the I's, and this will be perfect. And you know, he's physically a lot more what is talent, but he's a lot more fast twitch than me, and so therefore should have seen much quicker development than I did in a gym setting, and certainly didn't because of those things. So yeah.
If we turn to coaches who are listening, given your experience so far, everything that you've done at many different levels in the sporting realm, what would be your advice for coaches who want to become better at their craft?
Do it. Do the craft. And like when I say the craft, I don't mean the X's and O's. I mean like the actual coaching thing. So coach different people in different realms of the world, in different sports and that sort of thing. I think understand if you want to be an endurance coach, go coach team sports, because you develop different skills. So thinking about it from a development standpoint, we generally say, you know, you need general development and specific development, and then like sports specific development. Like think about it the same way from coaching. Go coach a different age group or a different thing, and you'll find that it is so challenging. One of the most challenging things I ever had to do was I started coaching when I was 17. So I just finished school and I was 17. That was my first thing I was coaching, and I was coaching fine. It was fine. No worries. Then 2 years later, or sorry, the next year, I just turned 18. I started coaching a girls' school in the track and field. And so some of these girls were my age or just a little bit younger than me. And so of course there's all sorts of concerns around this young male who's coaching these girls. And you know, I was very aware of them and very careful with that as a result. But what it made me do is I couldn't coach through any physical contact anymore. And that sounds a bit funny, but like so much of what you're doing with like males in the gym is like, hey mate, like push this, and you like put a finger on the back, or you go like chest up, or you do this, or you high five them on the way into the gym, shake their hand. Couldn't do any of that. Now all of a sudden I'm trying to explain a track start, but I can't physically make any contact with them. She's like, that changed the whole way I coached and how I use my words and all those things, you know. And then similarly, coaching in a different culture, I moved to the Netherlands. Now I'm coaching in a different culture. And the way they understand the sport, like their intrinsic knowledge of rugby, is not there in the Netherlands. In France, or at least in the south of France, most people would be able to explain the loose rules of rugby to me. In the Netherlands, it's not on TV. They don't see it. Like, no idea. So how do you teach somebody who's never seen rugby what rugby is? And this is what I had to do in the Netherlands, because there was a couple of guys who come down. They're like, yeah, I'm a hockey player. I heard rugby is fun. I'm coming. And I'm like, I've never spoken to somebody who has zero knowledge of rugby. In Australia, in South Africa, where you know I spent most of my lives, everyone understands rugby. Like, you know what it is, pass backwards, run forwards, ball looks like this. Most people can pass, they can probably kick, they've probably done a bit of it. Now all of a sudden you're like, hey, this is a rugby ball. And they're like, geez, that's a funny shape. I'm like, wow, okay. This is completely different. So I'd say that your true ability to coach is to coach like stuff, you know, areas outside of what you're used to and outside of shared understanding. And then probably the thing that helped that I actually did as part of a weightlifting qualification was video yourself coaching. It's very unpleasant, but it'll be very powerful learning for you. All of the mannerisms you don't like, you'll notice. All of the things you say that are filler words or that, you'll notice all these things. So yeah, film yourself coaching if you can, or get someone else to film you. I think it's super powerful. And then if you can and you have this ability, get other people to give you feedback, but not make sure that they are not cheerleaders for you. Right? So we all have cheerleaders, you know, probably our parents or whatever, close friends who will tell us they love everything we do. Try and find the people who are going to give you the feedback you don't want to hear, or that they think you need to hear, or that you want to hear, but no one will give you, right? That like tough feedback, like, hey, actually, man, like probably shouldn't have said that, or I don't actually like that program, or, you know, those things. Cause that's the stuff you need, right? And they're hard to find because that is an uncomfortable conversation to have with everybody.
I think this is a great, great piece of advice. And back to your teaching rugby to people that don't know rugby. I played rugby for quite some years. And when I came back from Canada 5 years ago, I helped the local team here with strength and conditioning. Eventually got to help with the Swiss Academy with the youngsters for a couple of years. And I went to one of the rugby, I guess, coaching courses here in Switzerland. And there's this guy, Luti, his last name is, one of the head instructors in Swiss rugby. And during the weekend, he had a class of kids. There were maybe seven, eight from the local school come up at the camp. And I kid you not, those kids had never seen an oval ball and never even yep. heard the word rugby. And he didn't even say the word rugby once. And within an hour, they understood. They understood, you know, the game line. They understand, you know, release once your knee touches the ground. They understood support. They understood how to take depth and come at speed. And he taught all that through a non-specific lens, just playing games with those kids. And it was probably one of the most mesmerizing feats of coaching that I've seen so far. Yeah. I mean, the amount of skill that it takes to, first of all, wrangle 20 kids that are here and that are, you're going to try and teach something that they don't know and they probably don't want to know at that point
yep.
is absolutely insane.
Yeah. I mean, I would have loved to have watched that. I've seen similar sort of things. I've spoken to people who doing advanced coaching courses in the Netherlands, like a master's of sports coaching. They had to coach a sport they didn't know to people who knew it, which is a little bit easier. So coaching a sport you don't know to people you don't know is about how do you actually coach, right? That is, it's making people be better. But yeah, those sort of things are when you start to really understand what coaching is versus what we think it is. Like many people think that coaching is like, here's a program, go do this, right? Be that strength and conditioning, endurance or whatever. But the coaching is all the other stuff. It's getting people to buy in and do the things and teaching them and helping them understand. Because again, we also think that, you know, and I struggled with this in the Netherlands was given my cultural differences was I used to say things and anticipate that to have an effect. But because of the lens they had, like what I said didn't mean the same thing as to them as what I was hoping it meant. So understanding that communication is what is received, not what is said, is super important here. So, you know, the guy you were mentioning, he taught via doing. He's like, here's the rules of the game, work it out. And then all of a sudden they understand depth, they understand these things. He's not teaching them that. He's not telling them, oh, when your knee goes to the ground, you have to release the ball. It's like, no, the rules of the game are X, now work it out. It's actually some of the most fun I had coaching. I did a gamification course through Coursera and then use video game design principles to help teach better tactical nous and certain aspects of the game plan to these guys who are playing top, you know, top level Dutch rugby, which is not a particularly high level, but you know, these guys are playing top level and it was like trying to get them to understand tactical adaptation better. So I use video game design principles in that. So like this person has this ability and this person has this ability. How are you going to use them? How are you going to adapt? What if that person does this? Now let's change the rules. Now you have to adapt. And they loved it. Like these are guys who are anywhere from 18 to like 30 and they loved it. And they really engaging, lots of running. So there's a fitness component to it, but also tons of tactical adaptation because teaching tactics, it's hard. You have to be exposed. Like it's so, so hard.
I've heard you say on a podcast while I was prepping for this one, how important you or how much importance you assign to marketing and communication.
Yeah.
I've come to a very similar perspective on the topic. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? I think it works in nicely with what we were just talking about.
Yeah, I guess I spent a lot of my life frustrated. Like, you know, I was a podiatrist in 2010. 2011 when Born to Run came out. So now I've got a bunch of people who are used to having orthotics and shoes coming to me saying, I'm throwing these in the bin. You know, you're selling snake oil. This is all garbage. And what you realize is like, I mean, that book is like Born to Run is just an amazing book. It's, you know, go read it. You're going to want to go run. You're probably going to want to throw your shoes out. You don't have to do that, but you're certainly going to want to go run. But you start to realize that like the storytelling aspects and the marketing aspects are so big in creating buy-in. And ultimately, we've all seen any coach listening to this has seen a terrible program work really well and a really good program's not work so well. And you start to understand the nuances, buy-in and buying into that situation and buying into you as a coach, buying into the program. And this is kind of what we're talking about with your testing. Maybe the testing is what they require. Maybe the in for them is I'm going to Sean because Sean does testing that no one else does. But then you keep them because of who you are. But if you don't do that testing, which is maybe a marketing tool fundamentally, and I don't want to talk badly about testing, I'm not talking it down, but it's an example. Maybe that's what gets them through the door. And then they can then spend time with Sean and go, actually, I really want to work with Sean. He does know what he's doing. I do buy into him. But without that, they don't buy in. So now do you do the testing or do you not do the testing? Whether or not you believe in it, right? Same thing with self-promotion on Instagram and all this stuff. Recently, I've started doing a lot more of this, putting myself out a lot more on social media and that sort of stuff. And I've found, you know, a lot more success from it. I'm the same guy. I'm doing the same stuff, but now people are seeing it. They're noticing it. They're hearing me talk on podcasts or whatever else. And then all of a sudden there's a lot more opportunity for me. And it's just something we're super uncomfortable with, particularly, you know, coming from an Australian culture where tall poppy syndrome is everywhere. It's really hard for me to do, but you know, when you start to see that success, you start to see the buy-in, all of a sudden you're like, oh wow, this person, you know, perception of your knowledge is just as important as the knowledge, right? I spent some time in America as a medical student, but in America, medical students wear doctor's coats. So now everyone's calling me doc and I'm being asked questions that, whereas in Australia, it's like, oh, that kid in the corner of the room, like, yeah, we don't, whatever. Right. So that stuff is super important, super contextual. Right. And yeah, I think, you know, they talk a lot about, you know, how you look, all that stuff. And, you know, maybe there's, you know, Nassim Taleb often talks about like, go for the guy that doesn't look good because he's going to have overcome that. And I tend to agree, but also the way to have gotten a lot of opportunities to look the part, right? Look the part, be early, do all those things so that you get the buy-in from people. Because if you don't, then that's a problem.
Yeah. And it's, I find it tricky sometimes on that front because there are a lot of people today that use those marketing tactics.
Yep.
Just grab your attention and then don't deliver on the back end. And I guess that's how I rationalize, you know, using copywriting. And as soon as you get into that realm, you're thinking psychology and it trends toward manipulation, or at least you're conscious of the person's emotional state or what you're trying to induce or you're trying to do in that space. And the way I think about it is if you have a valuable message, if you have something of value to provide and you know it's going to affect the person positively with no negative, you know, drawbacks, I think it's 100% justified to use those quote unquote tactics and approaches because you know you're going to have a positive impact. But then obviously it can also be used the wrong way around where you use kind of clickbaity, grabbing kind of that attention up front, but then you don't have anything of value on the back end. And hopefully that can help, you know, coaches that have things to say and that know that they can help people to do that better and to invest more energy into that. Because like you said, you could be the best coach. If nobody knows about it and you can't communicate it properly, then who cares? Nobody does. So if you want to actually make a difference, you owe it to yourself for all the skills that you've acquired, all the knowledge that you've built to learn and know how to communicate that effectively.
Yeah. I mean, look, you get to choose. You don't have to do it, but everyone else is. Right. So you get to play by whatever rules you want to set for yourself. For a long time, I was like, I will not get a job via nepotism. There is no way I will accept a job via nepotism. I will earn everything I get. Right. That was my view for a long time. I didn't want any job I didn't deserve. I was so like hell bent on that. That was fine. Everyone else is taking jobs via nepotism. So like there's a guy that I thought knew very little. And I know he knew very little at the time. He was a little bit ahead of me at university. He took got a couple jobs via nepotism. He's now working in elite sport and he's killing it. That's the job I wanted. I didn't get it. And he got it. And, you know, he's very smart now because he spent time in elite environments, right? Ultimately, he probably didn't deserve it, whatever that is, but he got it. And he probably did deserve it. You know why? Because he fit culturally, right? And then that cultural fit is so important. And I started to have that, like, that's wisdom where you understand your sort of mistakes of being younger. But what I'm getting at is, like, you don't have to play. You don't have to use this stuff. You don't have to use marketing. You don't have to do any of that stuff, but it's going to make your life easier. It's going to make you more effective as a coach and all those things. And as you say, like people will eventually work out that you're full of garbage or you're not. And so the people who are full of garbage are going to be out there doing it anyway, and they're going to be using these tactics. So you get to use it and try and be a force for good, or you get to not use it. And maybe some people find you and you make a, an impact where you do. And whatever it is, make sure that you pass the pillow test. This is something we talk about a lot in medicine. Pillow test is like, when your head hits the pillow, are you comfortable at night? Can you go to sleep? Because if you are, then that's all that really matters, right? So I think it's really important to like be comfortable in what you're doing and doing that. But I think using those tactics, just, it's unfortunately par for the course. But also, once you're aware of them and I would encourage people to learn them, because once you're aware of them, you can see through them.
Mm-hmm.
And you can start to see things, and you can start to very quickly highlight them and get rid of them. So like, there are, you know, whatever article pops up on whatever, and you go, oh, I might want to read that. You're like, given that title, I'm pretty sure it's going to be garbage and it's going to be something like this. And I, you know, so then you just don't read it. Right. So you're sort of bulletproofing yourself against the tactics as well.
You talked about it just then, culture, and that might be another realm where people throw the word around a lot and then it falls flat for some.
Yeah.
From your perspective, how do you build a high performance culture, whether it's in a sport organization, a team, with your athletes? What does it involve? What does it mean?
Yeah, it's hard, right? Like, there's that famous, like Tim Ferriss talks about it a lot. That cultural thing is like, you know, the old fisherman's pass to young fish and says, hey boys, how's the water? And they go, water, what's water? It's hard to know what culture is when you're in it. And I didn't really realize what Australian culture was until I left. Even though I'd moved there, you know, I wasn't born there. But certainly, as you move cultures, be that between different teams, between different countries, I'm sure you've got great perspectives on this. Like, you start to be acutely more aware of what culture is. I mean, culture is really hard to define. It's probably like a shared set of behaviors and understanding. It's probably the easiest way to think about it, is like agreements, understanding, meaning that we share. How do you create it? It's very hard. One thing I'd say about culture is like, it's almost the hardest thing to build and the easiest thing to break. Culture is about intention, it's co-creation. It's nobody owns culture, or the group owns culture, I'd say. So you have to co-create it, you have to agree upon it, you have to have buy into it, and then you have to have people who uphold it. And that's not just one person, it has to be everybody, and then it has to be consistent. Because, you know, you might, if your culture is you have to train to play, like, you can't select the best player if he doesn't train, right? Your culture may be, I will treat everybody fairly but not evenly. It's often said in American sport, right? Best players get treated differently. Like, you'll be treated fairly, but it's not going to be equally, right? And maybe that's what you decide. But whatever you decide, like, it's really hard. I'd say, yeah, I'm still grappling with this. Like, how do you create a high performance culture? I think it's, the other thing is, like, performance is not for everybody. High performance is not for everybody. Everybody, probably young coaches listening, like, you all want to work in high performance. I guarantee you, when like push comes to shove, a bunch of you don't want to work in high performance. And that's not a criticism. It's just, that's not an environment you enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy a high performance culture, probably not full time. I enjoy it step in and out of. I love development cultures as well, developmental cultures, because I find them, that growth mindset and the exploration and stuff, I really enjoy. So I probably spend time between the two if I have an option. When it comes to coaching sport, that is. When it comes to actual work, like, I want to be in a high performance environment. Like, hold me to a cord, call me out, do these things. You know, if a meeting starts at 3 p.m., I'm there at 2:55, with the exception of this podcast. My apologies, Sean.
it's not a high performance setting right here.
Yeah, well,
we're just kidding around.
clearly not, because of me. But, you know, so that's the sort of stuff I love and thrive on. And it's like, you know, let's have these honest and frank conversations, but that's super uncomfortable for a lot of people. And, perhaps, you know, as a manager or people who are managing these people, you need to be empathetic to that. And that's where I struggle to manage people, because I really struggle with not holding them to those standards. I set a really high standard for myself and other people, and then not holding people to that standard is really hard. But if you don't agree on it, can't hold them to that. Like, saying you're late at 3 p.m. because the meeting started at 3 p.m. Like, well, if you haven't agreed to being early, then they're fine. What's your problem? So I've done a good job of not answering a lot of questions this podcast. My apologies to the listeners, but how to create one? I think you have to sit down as a group and agree on some stuff. I would say, look at your cultural heritage. So some work I did in Amsterdam was looking at the cultural heritage of the club I was involved with. How did it evolve? What's the history of the club? So speaking of that, resonating with it, understanding what was there, and then building a game plan and a culture around that that reflected what the club was about. And that helped me get buy-in from people who were more senior at the club, ex-players who came back to watch, all those sort of things, and the player group as well. But I think it's about, you know, understanding where you are, why you are there, trying to create the future, but it's always going to be a reflection of the past and your collective experience. And some of that you will be part of and some of that you won't. If you're stepping in new, like you're going to bring your own stuff, but there's going to be a bunch of shared culture that you have to step into and understand. You might want to change some of that, and that's reasonable, but you may have to sort of accept some of that. But so you got to enroll people in culture, so bring them along, help them co-create, uphold some standards, and then be really consistent because it's fragile. Culture is that thing that your mum had when you were a kid that you weren't allowed to touch, that was in like the nice area of the house. That's what culture is. Like, it's super fragile. You have to use it a lot, but it is easily breakable.
That's a very nice way to put it. On that note, you've spent time with Olav and yep. the crew. What stood out to you in that environment from a cultural standpoint?
Oh, geez. Like, I couldn't be more complimentary of that environment. Olav is creating the most welcoming high performance environment I've ever seen. Mostly high performance is uncomfortable. It's not pleasant. It can be very like on edge, where everyone's, you know, trying to stressed out and high functioning, lots of laughing, lots of enjoyment, tons of work. Of course, I watched Christian do multiple hours of work around threshold, like, and multiple that is more than three or four. So like just unbelievable amounts of work. And that was around an athletics track between cycling and running. So like not exactly the most enjoyable thing from a psychological standpoint, but just super supportive, you know, welcoming, warm. Everyone wants to get better. We're all trying to get better here. That didn't go so well. That's okay. Like, what are the learnings we're taking? Just all of the things that you would want from a coach. And you know, I think probably the biggest misconception there is it's all data and lactate. I would say it's like a lot more of the other stuff. It's a lot more of the soft skills. Yeah, they measure a bunch of that stuff, and that is a small part of what they do, but it's all to contextualize the work that's happening. There's a ton of fun. There's a lot of jokes that happen, lots of laughing. All the meals are shared, every single one of them. Everyone's there, communal. Hey, we're meeting at this time for breakfast. Like, let's all be down here for it. It's just, you know, just a big team. I just felt super welcomed into that environment, which they didn't have to. And that speaks a lot to it. And just super warm people. They care. What do you do outside of this? You know, tell us about your wife. How can I help you get home? Like all those things. Like, hey, let me show you the quicker way around that. Like all of that stuff. So they, you know, there's that standard statement, like no one will care what you can do unless they know how much you care or whatever. Like I butchered that quote, but it's sort of, there's a high level of care there for humans, which is really interesting.
Switching gears a little bit, I want to talk about the performance health continuum.
Yeah.
Do you see a link, if any, between the performance health continuum and the general versus specific physical preparation and how one should approach that, depending on how you fall on that spectrum?
Yeah, it's probably a really nice analogy to draw. I'd say yes, now that you mention it. I hadn't really thought about it in that, like, in that light, but like to contextualize the performance health continuum, elite performance is not healthy, right? We know that. It's, or at least it's not the epitome of health. You can't be sick, right? You cannot, if you're physically sick, you can't perform. We agree on this. So there's a component that is necessary in health, but you know, the amount of carbohydrate eaten to perform at an elite level from a, you know, just on race day, for instance, and all the sugar and that, like it, I cannot believe it's healthy. You know, if we're talking 160 grams an hour of processed sugar, like just, you can't convince me that that's healthy, even if we're only talking about your teeth, right? Even if we just ignore the rest of it and just say it's bad for your teeth, right? So it's almost certainly not healthy elite performance. You've probably seen this as much as I have, like elite performers often have severe deficiencies in something. Not necessarily talking about like a blood marker, but maybe a movement or a whatever, like they're super restricted in this, like Rafael Nadal's, you know, like soldier crab look, like I can't imagine that's healthy for his shoulder girdle or whatever, right? So with the context of that not being healthy and optimal health not being necessarily conducive to performance, there's a continuum between the two. You need to be healthy enough to perform. Yeah, it probably is. You're probably right. You probably want to be healthier in an earlier phase of the season, try and address some of those deficits, trying to work on some areas of weakness, or you know, address some things. And then as you get into the season, it probably gets less healthy. I mean, body composition comes to mind as well. Like some of those, you know, elite body weight related sports, like towards the end they get down to the pointy end and they lose it. I mean, there's a paper that comes to mind is Trent Stellingworth and his wife Hillary. They tracked her across the season body composition wise. She's an elite 1500 meter runner, and he's a, I think he's a dietitian or something, but he works at the Canadian Sports Institute. Very good. And they've got this paper of her body composition across the season, her times and all that stuff. And she ends up, you know, with a period of time where she's super lean. I think she skipped a period or two, like, but that was very calculated. And they'd done a lot of work on exact energy measurements and helping her get down there. So, you know, is that the picture of health? Probably not. Is that what's required for her to run at the top level? I mean, there's an argument that it is. I mean, I'm not 100% convinced, but I'm open to being wrong on that.
As a self-proclaimed generalist.
Yep.
Can you strongman the idea of specificity and its importance and then do the same for general prep?
Sorry, rephrase that for me, sir. I missed that. Can I strongman?
No, no problem. Can you strongman specificity and its importance in sports and physical preparation? So the fact of, you know, doing the sport, doing the thing that looks like the sport, and then hold the opposite view as well?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, like, your ability to perform the sport is the ability to perform the sport, right? Like, so that's, you need to be specifically able to do those things. There are some niche skills. So let's use a rugby example, like a nine, a halfback, a scrum half, whatever you want to call them. Like, there are some very specific skills that will not transfer to another sport. They will not transfer from another sport, will not transfer to another sport. Box kicking, passing off the ground, these things, are, like, that is a niche skill. And your pure repetitions of that will find you being better, right? Best nine in the world, Antoine Dupont, spent a lot of time doing those things, right? He kicks off both feet, kicks those box kicks off both feet in a way, probably better with that left foot or his non-dominant foot than most nines kick with their good foot. That is sport-specific preparation. And that is very specific to that, what he is required to do on a day-to-day basis, week-to-week basis. He spent years doing that. I guarantee he was in a French academy probably since he was 16, 17, maybe younger. So yeah, like, that is sport-specific prep. And there's certainly, and that rugby is not even a sport of great specificity, to be honest. They're generally late specializing sports. You want to talk about tennis, golf, these things where, or swimming, gymnastics, where you specialize early, like, you just have to go do that. There are no adult onset swimmers who've ever qualified for anything that looks even like a regional competition. If you haven't swum a ton of laps by the time you are, call it 10, you are not qualifying for a regional event in anything ever. End of discussion. It's too technically heavy and it's too early a specialization sport. Maybe running. Okay. Maybe. Maybe you can be a more of a generalist, come to that later, having played a sport where you do a bunch of running. But yeah.
One thing that stands out on that specificity front that you just mentioned, and correct me if I'm off, but it's the, I guess, the hard physical skills versus the technical skills, technical, tactical, psychological, and where, I guess, where there's a bigger emphasis on the technical, tactical, psychological, maybe the earlier you should begin or the more exposure you need early on, versus if it's a purely, you know, physical, physiological, then maybe there's, you can take more of a longer way approach, more of a general approach to get to that and be better in the end for it.
Yeah, 100% agree. I think it's all about, yeah, it's all about the constraints of the sport and what that requires. I mean, that I specifically use Antoine Dupont as a good example because the counter example is Will Genia, for those who may be familiar, may not, Australian, played number nine. He picked up a rugby ball late. He was a cricketer. He only started playing rugby at, I think, 15 or 16. So, and, you know, has, I think he's probably got the most caps for the Wallabies at nine. He's still playing now. He's 30, he's probably 35 this year. Still playing rugby in league. Oh, I think he's league. No, he's with the Kintetsu Liners, so League One in Japan. So, you know, it's a late specialization sport, and he proved that. Scott Higginbotham, one of the guys he played with, started playing when he was very, very old as well. He was a soccer player, young, well, football player. So, yeah, certainly earlier in late specialization sports, as you say, the technical, heavily technical, perhaps technical sports require earlier specialization or more of it, perhaps, or more earlier specialization. But in general, I still think there is value in having some general base to it. It's just about how much. So in a gymnastics context, it's probably helpful for you to go do some sprinting, right? That would probably help your gymnastics. But at till what age? Because at some point, gymnastics hours is too many hours. Because some of these sports, swimming, gymnastics, tennis to a degree, golf to a degree, like, there's just many hours required. Many, many hours required. So
guess it's also the finding the right balance. And if we take the general prep as the base of the pyramid, just making sure that your skyscraper doesn't fall over if you just spend all your time at the top and not enough at the bottom, and maybe switching throughout the season, throughout the years, with between those different phases, and not, you know, spending all your time at one end of the spectrum so that you can, I guess, balance things out. That's just, I guess, just planning.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, look, there's lots of cynicism running around about these hybrid athletes at the moment. I think as a concept, it's helpful in society because I think they speak to a general level of fitness in the same way that CrossFit did in 2007. We went from like heavily specialists towards CrossFit. And, you know, so I was lifting, I was an Olympic weightlifting gym at the time and saw the advent of CrossFit. And I was like, oh, this is going to be big. And, you know, lots of people who say lots of bad things about CrossFit, but it brought the barbell back into the gym. It brought the gymnastics rings back into the gym. I can tell you when a guy who was trying to find gyms with like weightlifting platforms in 2007 until CrossFit came along, there wasn't many. So, and if you dropped the barbell, it was a problem. So, you know, like we tend to throw stones, but I guess the point I'm making is, you know, having a more general approach, I think is more helpful for a lot of people. And then hopefully you find something that works for you in your niche, whatever that is, right? As an athlete, that is, you know, one of the saddest, most rewarding, but also saddest cases I ever worked with an athlete was with a kid who was his mom was an Eastern Bloc gymnast. So she competed for the Eastern Bloc. So she was like super regimented. I worked with him from when he was like 11 till he was like 19. This kid was just one of the most kinesthetically aware, unbelievable athletes, lovely to coach, super respectful, lovely human. He was cleaning and snatching body weight very early and young and maintained that. He was very strong, did gymnastics. Ultimately, we were starting to talk about around 16, like when we start specializing, this kid was, you know, doing some road cycling on weekends. He'd play rugby. He was, you know, played a bunch of sports, played volleyball, gymnastics, all of it, but ultimately ended up being the wrong shape for everything. He was probably 6 foot, not much more. He's probably like just under 100 kilos, very lean. It's just like, can't play rugby. And he wanted to play like elite level rugby. I was like, she's not going to be big enough, man. Like there's nothing you can do. And it wasn't good enough track and field. It was too big for gymnastics. Like, but when I say rewarding, by the time we got to the end of working together, I would literally be in the gym talking to him while he did his program. Like he would write his own programs. I would look at them and go, yes, no, indifferent, or like, you know, let's change this or whatever. And he had learned partially through some of my stimulus, partially through his own intrinsic motivation, how to do all of that himself. And so that was a priority for him. So he learned it all. And so then now I look at him, he's very physically active on a daily basis now. And like that's success for me as a coach. So on some level, it's very happy. It's sad that he didn't make, you know, the elite sport he wanted to, but successful human, successful relationships, successful in sport in terms of he still goes out and does whatever he wants to every day, climbs rocks, runs, does some yoga, like does it all. And I think that's, you know, ultimately that's one of the most rewarding things is you've physically educated somebody so they can take that forward with them in through life. That's success, right? Like the guy I coached who made some representative team and stopped playing a couple of years later, like whatever, that's fine.
There's a strength and conditioning coach out of Canada. Her name is Carmen Bott. I think she works a lot in wrestling, that I was privy to spending time with when I was over there. And she said something that's stuck with me. And I used that quote even yesterday. And it dovetails nicely into what you just said, which is you need to, you know, treat and coach your athletes and clients, or coach them in a way that makes you unnecessary.
Yeah, yeah.
Put yourself out of the job in the way that you teach them and coach them. And then you have to treat them in the way that they never want to leave. So that's, you know, back to educating them, giving them all the pieces that they would need to do it themselves. But then, you know, making sure you bring that extra part of it. Like you said, you know, writing a program soon, we're not going to need somebody to do it. Something's going to do it for us, but it's the other part that we have to lean into and, you know, be present, be personable, or at least put emphasis on those relationships, because at the end of the day, that's really all that matters.
Yeah. And it's the bit that I enjoy about coaching and miss when I'm not doing it, and the X's and O's. And like, once I've written the program and solved that problem is actually the stuff I hate now. Like I hate, once I've solved that problem and written the program, I'm like, it's super boring to me, but the like being there and interacting with people, I love. So it reminds me of Ashley Jones's standpoint. I'm not sure if you've come across Ashley Jones's thoughts around the Crusaders and how he used to work with them, but basically when they were young players at the Crusaders, he would have complete control and he would slowly relinquish control. He may say, these are the movement categories and your rep ranges. Now you get to choose the movements. Mm-hmm. And then he would slowly relinquish control to a stage with Richie McCaw at the end where he'd be like, hey, Richie, what do you feel like doing? And Richie would do, you know, Richie would understand exactly what he needed to do and go and do it. And sometimes he'd say, hey, it's too much or whatever, but he would sort of slowly relinquish that control. And it's his thought around, like, he used, I think I'm going to butcher this because I listened to this podcast a long time ago, but he sort of talked about the thought around the belts in martial arts. Is kind of, you start with a white belt that slowly gets dirtier as you progress through, and then eventually the black belt becomes white through all of its use. So it's kind of almost like full circle thing. So I like it.
I like it. And I think it's a perfect place to end this conversation. David, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. Hour and 40 minutes. Didn't see the time go by. Jeez. As is usually the case with those great conversations. I want to really thank you for taking the time to come on the podcast. I know you listen into a lot of the episodes. I always appreciate your little texts and feedback when you listen to one. I hope people got as much out of this episode as I did, because I did a tremendous amount. And I hope we can you know, catch up soon for another one.
Yeah, please. Would love to catch up again, online or offline, on podcast or off podcast. I would actually just say to people, like, if you're listening to podcasts, please do like message the hosts or rate the podcast or all of the above. Like, you would be surprised how much of a difference it makes to a host or somebody who's creating stuff when you hear from somebody like, hey, I really enjoyed that. Doesn't take a lot of your time, sure, but like, it makes a huge difference to people. So please do that. And so, yeah, but thanks for the platform, Sean. I really enjoyed the conversation. It was, as you said, I didn't realize what time it was. So I, yeah, it's great. Really appreciate you and appreciate what you're doing.
If people want to find you online, where can they follow your adventures?
So I'll throw you some links. I've got, so Instagram, of course, at dlipman5. I'm on X. I don't do as much Xing or tweeting as I would like. I often say on podcasts, like, I think my drafts to sent ratio is somewhere around the 100 to 1. I'm certainly, I have my own podcast called 1% Better. It's kind of sports science, bit of storytelling in and around that. So some of your listeners may appreciate that. And then I have a Substack, Nexus Health Performance, where I sort of talk about the health performance stuff. So I've talked about already a couple of the articles, so I'll throw you that link as well.
Cool. We'll put the links below for people who are interested. David, thanks again.
Appreciate you.
Thanks a lot for watching this episode. If you want to support the show, there are two good ways that you can do so. You can leave a 5-star review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, or you can help grow this community by sharing this episode on your social media. Thanks for your support, and I'll see you in the next episode.